When I left this morning, it wasn't that bad, but apparently it's getting worse by the hour. So thank you for joining us. I know a number of our students probably didn't want to walk this morning, and I know some other people who probably needed to stay home for driving conditions. So thank you for joining us and making it a priority to be here. So we're partway through a series called I've Heard It Said. And so we're looking at things that we often hear in Christian circles. And, you know, I've heard it said. And we're trying to think not just how does this apply to me, but I'm hoping to equip all of us to speak to other people who have been raised in the church who may have heard these things said or may be saying these things themselves, particularly young adults. I'm increasingly aware that the church needs to not only try to disciple young adults, but to disciple adults. How to disciple young adults in their sphere of influence. And so we've had a practice over this series of imagining a specific young person or young adult that you know. Somebody who's grown up in the church, who would identify themselves as a Christian anywhere from 8 years old to 28 years old, right? So young person, young adult, somebody who's part of the unchurched generation. And depending on your state of life, this might be your own child, this might be a grandchild, it might be a niece, a nephew, you may be a young adult yourself. So this could be a classmate, a neighbor, a roommate. Somebody specific though, I want you to have a specific person in mind to kind of help make this a little more tangible. And as you think about this person, I want you to imagine a conversation with them, and I want you to imagine that they come to you with news that a close family member or a close friend has been diagnosed with a terminal illness. And they go on to tell you, after they share this with you, that somebody told this sick person, God won't give you more than you can handle. And they're wondering about that. How would you respond to that? Would you be tempted to say that yourself? That God won't give you more than you can handle. How would you proceed in that conversation? And this is what I'm hoping to equip us to do in these sorts of situations. So in times of grief, to comfort someone is a good instinct, right? And as we talk about this topic and as we move through this whole sermon, I want to lay the foundation that it is a good instinct to comfort someone in a time of grief or turmoil, affliction, etc. When a person is faced with seemingly overwhelming tragedy or affliction or some kind of trouble, we should reach out to them in care and concern. We should seek to support them in their need. Scriptures such as rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. Or that's in Romans, in Galatians 6, bear one another's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. These sorts of passages teach us to be concerned with the well-being of others, including their emotional well-being. Not just physical well-being, that's important, but their emotional well-being as well. But the statement, God will never give you more than you can handle, is not actually in the Bible. It's not technically true. And so we're going to unpack that over the course of the morning. The Bible doesn't say God will never give you more than you can handle. It seems like a nice thing for the Bible to say. It seems like maybe it could be consistent with what the Bible says. It also seems to be an encouraging thing to say to someone in times of trouble. But it is actually only a half-truth. And we're going to look at that and maybe find a better way to respond to people in times of trouble. And maybe see where this idea that, you know, people say, this kind of platitude people use, maybe see where it comes from. We're going to break the sentence down. We're going to look at three different parts that contribute to confusion around it. You'll see them highlighted in different colors. We're going to look at God and whether or not he actually gives us hardship. We're going to look at you in terms of what we are given and what we can handle on our own. And we're going to look at handle. What does it mean to handle something? We're going to unpack what we mean by that term. But before we get into that, there is actually a verse that sounds a lot like this statement. And I suspect it may be the main source of confusion around this idea. So If you don't have a Bible with you and you would like to read along, raise your hand nice and high. Our ushers have a number of Bibles they can distribute. We're going to read two passages, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 12 to 13 on page 811 in the church Bibles. So 1 Corinthians 10, 12 to 13, I realize as well you may have an electronic device and you're looking up your Bible. That's fantastic. If you have a Bible at home that you like to read and you call Priory Home, please remember to bring it on Sunday morning. There's nothing quite like finding these passages in your own copy and being able to be familiar with them or even mark them as we go through. So 1 Corinthians 10, 12 to 13, and then we're going to jump to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 is a famous chapter, but we rarely get to the end. So Hebrews 11, verses 35 to 40, which is page 852 in the church Bibles. But first, 1 Corinthians. Paul writes to the church in Corinth, picking up at verse 12. So, if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. So that's the verse that probably serves as the source of our misstatement, God won't give you more than you can handle. Now, turn to Hebrews chapter 11. We're going to pick up partway through a paragraph. It's the last few verses of the chapter, a very important chapter. Verse 35. Page 852 in the church Bibles. So, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 35 to 40. This is a long list of heroes of the faith that the author is describing. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned, they were sawed in two, they were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. What is this saying? What do these texts say? What's Paul saying in 1 Corinthians? You know, in the context of this section of 1 Corinthians, Paul is talking to his Gentile converts to Christianity who are still participating in pagan feasts in pagan temples because they recognize that these pagan gods are just idols. They're not real gods. And so Paul is actually talking about the danger of participating in idolatry even if you think those gods are false. Paul points in chapter 10 to the ways in the past that Israel flirted with idolatry, testing God. And they not only fell into sin, but God punished them for their sin. And it is in that context of God's faithful people flirting with idolatry and falling that Paul says, if you think you are standing firm, as the Israelites thought they were standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. He follows up by saying, no temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And here's the key. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. God never allows us to be tempted to the point we cannot resist if we use the tools he gives us. There's nuance to that statement. I want to ponder that for a moment. God never allows us to be tempted to the point we cannot resist if we use the tools he gives us. God himself does not tempt us to do evil, but he does allow us to experience temptation. This is wrapped up in the question of free will and living in a fallen world. But even when God allows us to be tempted, it is never so bad that we absolutely cannot resist or flee the temptation itself. Never will we be able to claim that temptation was too powerful. It's not my fault I gave in. And that's the key. That's the heart of this statement. Our failures, our giving in to temptation is always because ultimately we choose to do so. It may feel overwhelming at the time, but if it is temptation, we can always say no. We can always flee from it. And God gives us tools to battle temptation that if we use, we will escape. One tool God gives us to face temptation is escape. There are other tools as well, but in this text, it is specified that God will provide a way out of that temptation. As I was studying this, I thought of Joseph when he was sold into slavery and he was in Potiphar's house. He was very much trapped by Potiphar's wife who wanted to seduce him. It would have been very easy as a slave to say, "This is my master, I have to do what she says," and give in to that temptation. But Joseph literally fled the scene. Now, further things happened. But in that moment of temptation, that probably would have seemed very overwhelming, God provided a way out. Perhaps this way out that God provides, perhaps the tool that he gives us is calling a friend or a sponsor. Perhaps it's closing your mouth when you want to say something. Perhaps it's removing yourself from a situation. Ultimately, what this passage says is that we are never faced with such an overwhelming temptation that we lose our free will and are no longer responsible for our actions. That's what it means, that God will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we can bear. The temptations we face are never so overwhelming that we are no longer responsible for giving in. This is really what it means. And this is the closest Bible verse I can find to God will never give you more than you can handle. Now, here's the interesting thing, too, that sheds light on this question. The passage in Hebrews, this is not a passage that we really like to study in the West because, frankly, we have religious freedom and we have it really good. I think this is probably a much more popular, meaningful text in various parts of the world where Christians are persecuted. At first glance, it may not be clear how this passage, this violent passage, applies. The author of Hebrews is talking about great heroes of the faith in chapter 11, beginning with Abraham and Moses and going through all of them. And he gets to the end and begins to describe unnamed faithful people of God who suffered horribly in this life. Some of them were tortured, some imprisoned, some stoned. Usually that's a death sentence. Some were sawn in two. That's always a death sentence. They were put to death by the sword. Excuse me. God's people often face affliction and persecution that they cannot handle on their own. We don't experience that a lot in the West, but we are the minority throughout the history of God's people. Being sawn in two is not something one handles, right? Nor is being put to the sword. I'm not sure how many of us could say ourselves that we could handle being imprisoned for our faith either, although many Christians experience this and they do handle it. But affliction as well. I'm talking about persecution and affliction. Affliction isn't a word we use much anymore. It's a word we need to reintroduce into our vocabulary. Affliction means those negative experiences that come with living in a fallen world. Not as a direct result of our own sin. That's just the consequences of our actions and our sin. But affliction is things that are beyond our control and not the direct result of our sin. So getting cancer is an affliction. Floods that destroy homes are an affliction. A drought and famine are affliction. Losing your job because of an economic downturn is affliction. This is just the fact that we live in a fallen, broken world and bad things happen to all of us. It is true that God often works through affliction and persecution to glorify his name. That is true. Countries in which Christians are persecuted often become countries in which the church grows fastest. One of my professors was an Anglican. He was hired to teach at a Baptist seminary. And so to kind of get him up to speed on what Baptists were all about, they sent him to the Baptist World Alliance. And one of the delegates there said, they meet, I think, every 3 years. Last time we were here, we said we really wanted the church in our country to grow. And so we prayed for persecution and God has answered our prayer. This was the delegate from Turkey. And he said, the church is being persecuted and we're growing in depth and we're growing in numbers. Okay. My professor didn't know what to do with that. He's like, oh my goodness, these Baptists are crazy. But furthermore, even in our own lives, if we don't live in an area or a time of persecution, in our own lives, affliction and persecution can lead to our own spiritual growth. Difficult times can be times in which we put down deeper spiritual roots, that we learn more intimately the power of God's grace, and that we learn perspective. Yes, God can definitely use tough times to strengthen us and glorify his name in our lives and in our character, but that does not mean these are times that we handle on our own. Tough times are times in which we learn to depend on God more deeply. It is precisely because we cannot handle these times on our own that we turn to God and cling to him. We cannot handle these difficulties, so we turn to God and we turn to his people for support. I don't think the people in Hebrews 11 that were sawn in two would say, God never gave me more than I could handle. But they could say, God strengthened me to resist the temptation of denouncing him in order to save my own life. That's a profound difference. God strengthened me to resist the temptation of denouncing him in order to escape. So what does this mean? Well, first it means that we, or someone we know, when we're facing tough times, or somebody in our circle is facing tough times, we do need to follow that instinct to comfort them. But we need to resist the urge to offer platitudes, thinking that our words will make it better. We must resist the urge to say, everything's going to be okay. We must resist the urge to say, God will never give you more than you can handle. So let's take a look at that statement. God will never give you more than you can handle, and let's compare that to what we've seen in Scripture. Sin in the world is the source of hardship, not God, even if God allows it to affect us. So sin is the source of hardship. Not necessarily your sin and your hardship, but the fact that globally we are fallen, there is sin in the world, that is a source of hardship. And how often does God use this to draw us to himself, to teach us perseverance and to refine our character? When hardship is the result of our own sin, God allows us to experience that too. As a reminder, we need him and that our actions have consequences. But God is not the source of these hardships. And so I would say God does not give us any of these things. So my first complaint with that statement is that the hard times you are going through are not given to you by God. In the 1 Corinthians text, it specifically says, God does not allow, rather than God causes. God's ultimate goal may not be our goal. God's goal is to glorify his name in the world. Our goal, usually, is to live safe, comfortable, happy lives. And sometimes those two are cross purposes. The fact that God's goal is to glorify his name in the world means that his faithful people are sometimes martyred. It may be through our death that he is most glorified. Certainly, the example of Jesus shows us that God's greatest glory came through the death of his own son, the most glorious, faithful, and only perfect person to ever live. God's goal is not that we live comfortable, easy lives. God's goal is not that we white-knuckle through life and do everything under our own power, either. What you can handle is far less than what the church can handle or what God can handle. This is that you part of the statement. God will never give you more than you can handle actually assumes you can handle everything life throws at you on your own. But that's just not true. It's actually patently false. Because we need God. And we need a Savior. And we need Christ's body, the church. We need fellow believers for support, encouragement, guidance, and teaching. Paul says in Galatians 6 that we are to bear one another's burdens, those burdens that are too much for one person to bear on our own. And so those burdens exist. There are burdens that are greater than you can bear on your own. And it is up to us to share them with the church, the broader Christian community. That's why God gives us fellow believers, so that when these burdens come upon us that are greater than we can bear, we have Christian community established that can bear the weight with us. God's name is glorified when the church supports one another. In the West, we value autonomy. To be honest, I think autonomy is probably our greatest idol. We want to do things on our own way, under our own power. We want to be in charge because it's, in part, is because then we get the credit. In part, it's because autonomy is at the heart of our rebellion against God. We want to do it ourselves. We want to be like God, which is autonomy, including deciding whether or not to eat the forbidden fruit. But that isn't God's plan. That's not God's goal for us, to all be autonomous, isolated individuals. Rather, he has called us to be a community, the parts of his body in the world, working together, supporting one another, protecting and encouraging one another. More than you can handle assumes autonomy, not community. It feeds our ego that I can handle anything God sends my way. You can too. Or anything that the world sends our way with God's permission. It also places an impossible burden on us to try and handle everything on our own. You say to me, Pastor Dave, God will never give you more than you can handle. And I say, are you kidding? He gives me more than I can handle on a regular basis. Even with the help of the church community, though, we still live in a fallen world and faithful people still suffer and die. But we know that that is not the end of our story. Hebrews 11, the author talks about how these martyred heroes of the faith did not receive their full reward, but instead, God has something far greater in store for them together with the church, so that all of God's faithful people would be made perfect or complete together. God will ultimately handle everything when Christ returns. At the resurrection, when Christ returns, when Christ sits in judgment over the world, then everything will be handled. The persecuted faithful will receive their full reward. Those who persevered through hardship will receive their reward. We will be given new bodies that will not suffer or decay. That's when everything will be handled and handled by God. So God may, in fact, allow us to experience things that we cannot handle in this life, that the church cannot handle along with us, and we may die. But God handled all of those things on the cross and will finish handling them when Christ returns. Then and only then will everything be set right, and that is our certain hope and nothing less. So how do we apply this? Remember, bring it back to that young person, that young adult that you know, and imagine that they are facing affliction, tragedy, persecution, something. How are we going to talk to the person in need? I want to reinforce our desire to encourage, support, and help people who are suffering is a good thing. We need to do this. But telling them that essentially everything's going to be okay is not actually helpful and may not be true. It puts the burden back on them. To buck up, power through it. You can handle it on your own strength. Instead, we need to enter into their grief and into their discomfort and validate it. We need to let them know that, wow, what you're facing really stinks. I am so sorry that this is what you're going through. I'm overwhelmed at the thought of that. When offering comfort, mourn with those who mourn. When someone is sad, enter their sadness with them. Don't try to avoid sadness or uncomfortable feelings by telling them it will be okay and changing how they feel. Commiserate with them. I love that word, commiserate. Misery together. commiserate. Listen to their pain. Listen to their fear. Listen to their sadness. Let them know they are not alone. That you will help bear this burden with them, and that the broader Christian community can help them bear this burden too. You know, as a side note, you know, being a pastor, people come to me with lots of their struggles, and that's why I'm here, and that's good. Over the past few years, I have been distressed at the increasing number of people who are faithful members of this church family who come to me and share things that they're struggling with that are not embarrassing or privacy issues, but they really don't want to go to the broader church for prayer or support. It concerns me, because frankly, we're here to support one another. And I'm concerned that it's potentially an issue of pride that people don't want to share, that they can't handle it on their own. But I've seen this pattern over the past few years from faithful members of the church who love the rest of the church and are loved by the church who don't want to share. And it's, I'm not talking about like embarrassing things or issues of sin or things like that, but just like the affliction that comes with life. I want to encourage you not to put a brave face on and say that everything is okay, that it's nothing you can't handle, or nothing you can't handle with the help of the pastor. Because there's a lot you can't handle. Let us handle it with you. That's part of that Galatians 6:2, bear one another's burdens, is that we have to be willing to admit our burdens and let the church carry it with us. When you're in the role of comforting another, when the time is right, remind them that God will ultimately handle everything at the resurrection. That's not where you start. Timing is important. You know, they come to you and say, I've just lost my job. Well, that's okay, because at the resurrection. No. Timing is important. Don't rush to remind them. First, mourn with them. Then, in cooperation with the Spirit, once you know their fears, their pain, their suffering, or burden, remind them that at the cross, Jesus won the great victory. Remind them that Jesus not only died for their sin, but promised to come back and fix all the damage from sin in the world. That includes our sin, that includes the sin of others that affects us, and the general brokenness caused by humanity's rebellion against God. Your presence will be greater comfort than your words. That's actually something I learned as a pastor in kind of grief counseling. Don't try to say something that will make it better. Your words will not make it better. Instead of trying to fix their situation or their feelings with your words, fix it with your ears by listening, your hands by hugging, your whole self by being present with them in their struggles. Encourage them with your words by telling them they are not alone, that they have a community that loves them, and they don't have to face this by themselves with their own strength. Point them to Jesus by being his hands and feet in their life. Because God's plan for the church includes helping one another handle what we cannot handle on our own.